The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Now, you and your colleague Dan Rasmussen at Verdad Capital recently wrote a piece for Institutional Investor about private credit. Before I have you get into that, just for what, by way of background, private credit is something that has really exploded in recent years. Anybody who's been around the institutional investor community at all will know this. You know, hedge funds were pretty much the story last decade, or actually 2 decades ago now. Private equity still is big with institutional investors, but this private credit has come on in recent years, and the whole asset class has exploded. And you guys reference this in your story. In 2004, it was only the size of this asset class was only some $30 billion, and now it's $260 billion or something like that. I may not be getting those numbers entirely right, but exponential growth in this. And it's something that, as I said, institutional investors have flocked to and have produced pretty good returns, which is not something that they can say of their hedge fund portfolios necessarily. So all that in mind, you guys are a little bit cautious on this asset class. In fact, the title of this article is High Yield Was Oxy, Private Credit Is Fentanyl. Investors are hooked and it won't end well. So, Greg, take us away here. What are your issues with private credit?
Sure. And let me set the stage. I would say that we are worried about private credit. And when we look out at the lending world, I think where to start is just how we view credit in general. And there's a concept that we've been talking a lot about that we call fool's yield. And it's an idea that it should be intuitive, but it's a bit counterintuitive. And that is, as you buy higher yielding instruments, stuff that has a higher face yield, at a certain point, you make more money. And then at a certain point, that tips and you make less money. And you can see this in credit lending or lending across the globe in all sorts of different asset classes. To use an example that's completely outside of this area, if you look at LendingClub, which is consumer lending, they provide loans that range anywhere from 7 to 25% yields. It turns out that none of those vintages, and they do a great job providing the data, have really had above 6% returns. And furthermore, the highest returns have been with the lowest yielding, the lowest rate loans they make. And the reason is really simple. If you're borrowing money at 25%, there's a really good chance you're not going to pay it back. And so the default rate is very high and you end up getting bad returns. Well, the same thing holds true in credit. And so if you go look out across the credit universe, the highest yielding parts of that universe, the single B and triple C universes, don't have materially higher returns and often lower returns than the safer stuff in the investment grade and the double B universe. And so what you have is declining returns to incremental risk as you go down the risk spectrum. And this is something that's been true for decades. This is a feature of how lending works. So private credit, when you look at what private credit is, it is unrated and it's private. But a lot of what's being done are loans that would clearly be rated B or triple C, the bottom end of the credit quality spectrum. And so when you hear private lenders go out and talk about the yields available, and they really do talk about what the yields are available on loans, that's not something that you should expect to get. Now, it's been a good market for private credit, but it's been a good market for what was a much smaller set of private credit lenders filling a specific need. What's happened over the last few years is that the nature of the borrower has changed. I think when you think about when you think private credit, this sounds like making loans to businesses that just aren't public, that don't have access to the credit markets, and that used to be true, that you're making these small specialized loans that other people aren't going to make. And that is what private credit was and really what it was designed to be. But what's happened in a large portion of the private credit markets is that private credit has turned into loans to private equity firms. And private equity firms are voracious consumers of debt. When they buy out a company, they need to put on enough debt, as much debt as they can. And that's really been true, especially as the multiples on private equity buyouts have been going up and up and up and up. So in the past, and when we talk about high yield, it used to be that private equity firms would go out and get a bank loan, maybe from a commercial bank, more recently from a CLO or the leveraged loan market, put a slice of high yield on top of that was rated B or triple C, that was pretty risky, but everybody knew it was risky, and that's how they'd finance it. What's been happening a lot more in the last 5 years is that you've been getting all the financing, the entire stack, from these private lenders. And so you have very highly leveraged loans being done in a single loan, and that's a much more dangerous kind of lending than I think people appreciate, especially people who are going into private lenders whose historical track record is based on what really was a different kind of lending.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a lot of these loans are coming from private equity deals to finance buyouts. Do you have a breakdown on the percentage of what percentage is for private equity deals and what percentage is just for, I guess, business operations?
One of the things about writing this article is you realize how little information, consolidated information there is about private credit. But we do have really good evidence from the leveraged loan market. Mm-hmm. Now, the leveraged loan market are these larger deals that are also done for private equity firms, but they have ratings. They're reviewed by the rating agencies because they're getting packaged and put into collateralized loan obligations, which is a securitization vehicle. When we look at those, it's upwards of, it's about 60% of those loans. And when you get down into the lower quality, even more of those loans are to private equity firms. When a private equity firm finances, they tend to finance in the single B area in leveraged loans. And what you can see over time is that as private equity has grown, the share of single Bs in the leveraged loan market has also grown and is now a majority of the market versus the high yield bond market, which everybody thinks is so dangerous. 50% of those bonds, which don't finance, which are just to normal corporates, are double B rated. Higher rated. So you've actually got this weird situation now where the market that private equity used to finance its deals is the leveraged loan market. And that market, which sounds safe, floating rate, senior secured loans, is now riskier than the vast majority of the high yield bond market or the majority of the high yield bond market. So we have good evidence from the liquid markets, how large this effort is. And when we talk to people in private credit shops, I mean, a lot of them, I will just tell you that they do almost 100% sponsored finance loans, is what they call it. And the reason is simple, right? The sponsor has gone out and scrubbed the data, and it's a ready-made source of loans. It's much, much harder to go out and find that small company that needs a loan and do all the work to scrub the financials. It's much, much easier to make a loan to a private equity firm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got a couple of issues here potentially with this. First of all, as more money chases these deals and more institutions get involved with this, the yield comes down, right? So that's the one thing. So the returns that investors are going to get on these, one would think, are going to be compressed quite a bit. That's the first issue. And then the second is, what about systemic risk? Like how much this market is opaque. It sounds an awful lot like some of these mortgages and things like that were going on 10, 15 years ago that, of course, led to the financial crisis, in that it's an opaque market. It's potentially a lot riskier than it appears. And everybody's saying it's safe. There's a lot of money chasing it. and how many people are tied up in this systemically? Like, it's not the banks anymore that are making these loans, right? Do they own any piece of this, or where is the risk?
Yeah, but actually, so if you go back historically, when banks used to make these loans, obviously they have levered balance sheets, and so they were they have to be much more cautious. They have actually increased slightly their lending into what they call the C&I market, the commercial and industrial market. They just haven't increased nearly the pace that the broad syndicated markets for bonds, syndicated loans, and then private credit have grown. But what's really interesting about the expansion of this market, and it's grown dramatically, sub-investment grade lending is now 27% of GDP, up from about 5% in late 1980s. So this has been a growth market, loans, bonds, private credit, everything. What's interesting is that now it's mostly funded by real money. It's funded off pension. It's funded by pensions. It's funded by real money. So you don't have that, with the exception of leveraged loans, which are securitized vehicles. About 60% is held by CLOs. The private lending market is really just pension funds and endowments and or other real money going in and providing it. So I'm not sure there's a blow up risk. What I think you're going to get much more in this market is a very disappointing set of returns for institutions that really have a 7% target hurdle. Yeah. That's why they went into this in the first place. And they're not, there's a chance they won't get it and that their capital will be locked up for a long time in what is a slow motion train wreck. But remember, this is also tied to private equity. The equity below this stuff that we're concerned about is private equity. And when you talk to private, we've polled private equity investors, when you poll them what they think the underlying credit ratings are of their private equity holdings, many of them think it's double B and some even investment grade, when in reality, this is single B and even low single B that they're holding. So I think there's an underappreciated risk from the private equity firms that they are subordinated to risky debt. And therefore, you really could have some spectacular blowups in private equity. And there, the systemic effects are just the employment numbers. You know, these companies do employ a lot of people across the United States. And the more you lever them up and the more you put them at risk, the more you potentially hurt their growth prospects. I mean, they go through Chapter 11, they might still exist, but you're not growing while you go through Chapter 11.
Yeah, you're talking about the portfolio companies now, not the private equity firms.
I'm talking about the portfolio companies, correct. Yeah.
But private equity has been pretty good at squeezing returns out of these companies for its own purpose, right? They charge fees on the consulting, and usually the returns that they get for their investors are pretty good. Although your colleague, Dan, has a whole another thing on that, which we will get into some other point. But my point is here that the private equity firms are able to protect themselves usually. So is there any reason to believe that it'll be different if there is, if this stuff comes due and these companies go belly up?
Yeah, so I mean, private equity firms have been very good at writing terms and into both the leveraged loans that we can see, and then we also understand from the private credit deals that that really give them the ability to, one, take out capital, but also negotiate when they get into trouble and effectively fudge the numbers. Yeah. What we're finding in private credit is that there is no such thing as default. There is only renegotiation. Right. So the private equity firms own the bank. Right? When they get into trouble, they're going to go to the private lenders and renegotiate. And so the private lenders are also going to be forced to take a haircut. Now, what would normally happen, and I don't think the private lenders have the capacity to go take over all these private equity firms. So there's going to be a negotiation. And what we've seen, when we went back and looked at, and actually it wasn't us, but there's some great work out there on the renegotiation rate of. And when you look at the renegotiation rate, how many of these deals get renegotiated, it maps very, very closely to the default rate on single B credit in the public markets. So it's pretty clear that the credit quality of these loans is single B or below, and that they're acting much like we'd expect credit quality of that to act. But yes, I think private equity firms will renegotiate. It will be a discussion. But listen, if you get a whole lot of private portfolios in trouble, you can't save them all. I mean, a portfolio company in trouble, you can't save them all. And if they're all highly leveraged, that's a real problem.
Okay, Greg Obenshine, I want to take a short break and then we'll come back and ask you a little bit more about this world of private credit and where it may be headed next. But let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Let's talk a little bit about here. This is the segment of the show where I have our guest tell listeners a little bit about his or her background as an investor, where his or her previous stops were along the way, and how he or she came to be where he or she presently is. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to be here?
Sure. I was not a finance guy to start. I did not do an investment banking program. So I'm one of those guys. I was a management consultant before business school. Came out of business school and still didn't do finance. I took a lot of finance in business school. I got a quantitative degree in finance in business school, but didn't pursue that. First, I went into renewable energy and worked for GE Wind Energy. Went through GE's leadership program. So I'm a guy who's a consultant and sort of an industrials guy, but was always fascinated by finance, and actually got my CFA while not working in finance. Just took the tests and figured it out. Sort of became self-taught. And then ended up in the early 2000s at a wonderful firm called Stone Tower Capital, which was one of the early CLO lenders. So I understand CLOs very well. Did leveraged loans, focused on energy, eventually switched over to running the high yield portfolios for them. We were acquired by Apollo. So I ran high yield for Apollo for 4 years. So I'm very familiar with both the leveraged lending universes and the private equity, the debt side of the private equity groups. And then after that, decided that the world was going quant. And so much the way that I took the CFA and taught myself that part of it, I taught myself to program and started doing some very quantitative deep dives on credit. And so a lot of the work that you see is actually based on a much deeper background than we've talked about. But now take a fully quantitative approach to, really a quantamental approach to credit, using data that not a lot of other people have put together, and and it's where a lot of the insights around fool's yield have come from, and why I can look inside the high yield market and see the credit stats all the way down the stack, all the way down the rating stack, so have very good reason to be concerned about what's going on at the lower end.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. How does that all play out and what causes it? I mean, I'm assuming that, higher interest rates are going to be one of the things that trips these things up. It typically is, right? But how does that all play out? How big is this market and how big is the fallout?
Sure. To start on size, it's about $5 billion triple B, which is investment grade. But then it goes it's about a trillion of investment grade. A trillion of investment grade, yep. A trillion of high yield. It's well over, it's 5 trillion of triple B. And I don't even know what the rest of the investment grade market is. It's a trillion of leveraged loans. Leveraged loans are now larger. There's more of them. And remember, lower rated than high yield. And then the numbers we put about 300 some billion in private credit, although that number is very hard to pin down. So that's the size. It's not so much interest rates. It is rates going up, but it's rates going up because the spreads to the treasuries, the risk on these loans starts to increase. And then people don't, the way this typically works and the way that it used to work is that the minute the economy started looking a bit wobbly, banks would pull back on lending. And you'd see this in the lending standard surveys. They would increase their lending standards. You had a withdrawal of liquidity from the market. And then the weakest players started to get in trouble. And you got a snowball effect. The more they looked like they were in trouble, the more people would make them repay to refinance. The more you had to pay to refinance, the more other people got into trouble. And you get this snowball effect. Well, now that it's all institutional money, what's really going to matter is the flows. Once you start seeing some real credit blowups, and it'll take some headline blowups to give people pause and have the flows stop into this market, that's when you start to see withdrawal of liquidity. There isn't the ability to refinance. Or the ability to refinance is at such a high rate that it's not worth doing. And that's what creates the unwind. But it's a credit and liquidity unwind more than it is some it's internally generated by credit problems.
Do you have any idea of the type of returns that institutions or investors were getting from these private credit investments? Historically, and what they've been, they've come down obviously as due to all these issues that we've discussed. But do you have any idea of the specific numbers of what they were and what they are?
Yeah, so returns have come down for everybody. So I don't want to just pick on private lending because I think they've come down in line with everybody else. But I think they've come down more recently, probably not in line. I mean, actually more. I've seen numbers suggesting they were around 10%. When we look at the public BDCs as the best proxy, that's actually about 7% since 2004 versus about the same on the high yield index. So absolutely no premium for taking the illiquidity and leverage risk there. But those you could argue are high fee leverage structures that have reasons they'd underperform. For the private lenders themselves, I've seen numbers anywhere from 8 to 12, but it's very hard to confirm those numbers. I think the thing that is always surprising when you go and look at any of these private asset classes, is that once you adjust them relative to the public markets, the premium that you get is far less than you'd expect. And that's right. The best lenders I know, I usually don't name names, but I think Ares is a very good lender. And they've done about 10%. I'd put them at the upper end of the BDC. Their BDC is at the 10%. I'd put them at the very upper end. But there have been a lot of people below that. And the drawdowns in these strategies, these private credit strategies, especially since some are levered, so these funds actually aren't, they themselves are levered while making these levered loans. The drawdowns on BDCs are absolutely horrific in downturns. Down 70% in 2007 for the BDC index, down, I think it was maybe 30 or so in 16. So they have been high, I would say, given where there's a lot of compensation for credit risk right now, and there's a whole lot of credit risk being taken.
Yeah, although 10% is still not bad.
But that was back when rates were higher. No, that you would have made 7% on a lot of stuff, 8% out there. No, that's historical, and everything was better historical.
Oh, I see. So now it's come down to
it's come down. No, I would not say you're there now. I mean, you'd at best be getting a premium over the high yield markets, and I'm going to guess you're going to not going to get a premium over the high yield markets.
Okay.
And those are at 5% right now.
And yet, there's a lot more lenders going into this space.
Yeah.
There's a lot more hedge funds that are doing this. There's a lot more everybody that's doing this. So, which of course is partly what's causing the compression in yields, I would think. Is that something else that you're seeing, that there is there's a lot more competition for these loans?
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago, I mean, even in 2016, you didn't hear about private credit that much. I mean, private credit was, well, first of all, it was called middle market lending. it's been rebranded. Right. And really what it was you did a first lien loan, and then if you did a stretch piece for a private equity deal, you did a high yield bond, or you did a second lien loan. And what's happened is all of a sudden we started to call it private credit. And the only distinction is that there's no publicly available financials or ratings, but you're putting a lot of leverage on it and doing it to a private equity firm. And somehow that's supposed to look like what you imagine credit would be, which would be loans to small firms that couldn't get them otherwise, but that might otherwise be good credit risks. And so I think there's I began to scratch my head a few years ago, and I kept hearing about private credit because I remember I was thinking, well, this is not a particularly good space. And how is all this money going there? I've never seen that many opportunities there. And I'd been in that space for, 10, 12 years, and it was never a large space, because if you think about it, also smaller companies don't need as much debt, right? So how do you generate the amount of debt? I mean, how do you, the other question is to flip it around and be like, where's the need for this debt coming from? How is it possible that you can invest this much money that's coming into the space? Where's the demand for this money coming that didn't seem to be there before? And the answer is it's coming from private equity, and it's coming from private equity buying companies and putting a lot more debt on them. So it's a leveraging up. It's a risking of the market that wasn't there before.
How far away are we from this starting to unwind, do you think? It does not seem that investors are getting at all wise to this yet, based on what I've seen anecdotally. Maybe you have a different experience.
So I think it's who knows? I mean, yeah. I'm not going to step into the market timing question. I do think there'll be some sort of, you know, we had WeWork and venture capital that sort of opened everybody's eyes, and I think there'll be a few blow-ups in private credit. You know, you'll see there's sporadic articles every once in a while right now about restructurings in private credit, and I think as people start to pay attention to it more, you'll get a few more headlines about these blow-ups, and then there'll be, you know, there'll be firms that just have several bad deals, and it's going to be hard for them to put up good returns. And so I think you'll start to see the bloom come off the rose a bit once the performance starts to suffer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what not a place that investors would want to put their money? And I guess there are ways for retail investors to get access to this, like the BDCs that you mentioned.
Yeah.
So flip side of that, what are some more constructive areas for investors to put their money to use here?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've talked to people about is if you have a 7% return hurdle, first of all, you should probably never. I mean, it's always difficult trying to invest with a return target. But let's say you have a 7%. You know, at some point you've got two choices. You can go out and take a lot of risk to try to get that 7%, and most likely you're not going to get it. Mm. Or you can just accept reality and figure out how to live within that. Investment grade now is 3%. If you could dip down to double Bs, it might get up close to 4%, but it's even below that now as there's been a big rally. But those are returns that statistically you're likely to get. And at some point, you look across the world and you see negative rates in Europe and you see, you know, high equity valuations, and you might say to yourself, and I think it's good that actually maybe performing credit, I mean, the traditional credit isn't such a terrible place to be. So at least you know what you own, and if there's opportunities that come along, you can go to them. But you're not taking a crazy risk. I mean, people talk about triple B credit, but these are three times levered companies with massive equity market caps. Listen, if you think triple B credit's getting in trouble, then you might as well short the public equity markets, because that's what's below the triple B credit. You know, or you go where there's low valuations. You go to Europe. You go to we think Japan is, you know, very attractive right now. Now they don't pay dividends, or they don't return cash to shareholders, which is a problem. But the valuations are very, very low in Japan right now. So you go outside the U.S. Or you actually do the opposite of taking risk. Mm-hmm. You go into things that are going to pay you. Mm-hmm, over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So income generating things. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but not necessarily income generating. I think income generating then leads to this chase for yield.
Okay.
I think when you think about credit, you think first, what is definitely going to pay me? Mm-hmm. And then you go from there. I think there's been many, many great marketing schemes on dividend yield that never really comes true.
Okay, very good. So lastly, tell us a little bit about Verdad Capital and where we can find you online. I see you have a Twitter, although not all that developed, certainly not as developed as mine or people like me who tweet multiple times a day, because we have nothing better to do.
Yeah, so you can also follow us at Dan Rasmussen, who runs the firm. He's at Verdad Cap. And it's a good way to stay updated. We have a website at Verdad Advisors. Verdad Advisors really focuses on small cap levered equity, really private equity in the public markets. And our background is studying private equity, and many of us come from a private equity backgrounds. So that is originally how the firm got started. Within the firm, I'm the head of credit. I focus on the leverage part. The actual debt part, and really, as I mentioned before, have a quantitative developed a lot of quantitative, well, quantamental approaches to credit, which have generated the kind of insights we talked about here. So we are really levered capital structure experts.
Very interesting. Okay, cool. Yeah, verdadadvisors.com, and please check Greg out on Twitter as well. All right, that'll do it for today. Thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.